Details emerge on the lone gunman behind Canada's shootings as their parliament honors the man who took down the assailant. Good evening. I'm Judy Woodruff.
And I'm Gwen Ifill. Also ahead this Thursday, from vaccines to better hazmat suits, science steps in to advance the fight against Ebola.
Syria's untold stories, the obstacles and looming dangers for journalists witnessing and reporting on the nation's civil war.
You're up against two problems. One is the so-called Islamic State. They'll kill you. And then you have the Assad government that restricts visas. Right now, there are no visas for U.S.-based correspondents, people who hold U.S. passports.
Plus,
the egos in this business.
A star-studded cast revives a play about the politics of Broadway and the comedy backstage.
Those are some of the stories we're covering on tonight's PBS NewsHour.
Major funding for the PBS NewsHour has been provided by BNSF Railway and by BAE Systems. Inspired work. Supported by the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation. Committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information at macfound.org. And with the ongoing support of these institutions. And
this program was made possible by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and by contributions to your PBS station from viewers like you. Thank you.
Canadian police announced today they found no connection between two fatal attacks this week on soldiers. That word came as Parliament cheered the man who put an end to yesterday's shooting assault in Ottawa.
A hero's welcome awaited Sergeant-at-Arms Kevin Vickers at the opening of the day's session of Parliament. He was visibly emotional as lawmakers stood in thunderous applause. It was Vickers, a former Royal Canadian Mounted Policeman, who shot and killed the gunman stalking the halls of Parliament yesterday. The incident touched off panic as police rushed in and lawmakers and staffers scrambled to get out.
The goal of these attacks was to instill fear and panic in our country and to interrupt the business of government.
Today, just 24 hours after the chaos, Prime Minister Stephen Harper insisted Canada will not be intimidated.
We'll be vigilant, but we will not run scared. We will be prudent, but we will not panic. And as for the business of government, well, here we are in our seats, in our chamber, in the very heart of our democracy and our work.
And in a chamber often divided by politics, unity was the message of the day.
Yesterday's events were a shared national tragedy. It is fitting that we have come together in this place immediately to let the world know that Canada's values are strong, our institutions are resilient, and our people are united together.
It only strengthened our commitment to each other and to a peaceful world. Now, let us not become more suspicious of our neighbors. Let's not be driven by fear, because in Canada, love always triumphs over hate.
People now say the lone gunman, Michael Zahaf Bibo, was a recent convert to Islam with a long record of violent crimes. They released security camera video today showing the gunman running into the Parliament building with a rifle. Minutes earlier, he's seen entering the National War Memorial grounds, where he shot and killed Corporal Nathan Cirillo, a member of the Honor Guard. Park benches near the site filled with flowers today as Canadians paid their respects. Back at the Parliament, lawmakers paused for a moment of silence in remembrance of Cirillo. Family members of the shooter condemned his actions. In a statement, his mother, Susan Bibeau, said, "We wish to apologize for all the pain, fright, and chaos he created. We have no explanation to offer. I don't understand, and part of me wants to hate him at this time." Police now say Zahaf Bibeau had recently applied for a passport, apparently intending to go to Syria, but he was not under surveillance.
I can confirm that Zihab Bibo was not one of the 90 high-risk travelers that the RCMP is currently investigating. According to some accounts, he was an individual who may have held extremist beliefs.
His attack came just days after another Canadian with Islamist militant ties rammed two soldiers with his car near Montreal, killing one before being shot dead by police. Investigators said they found no connection between the two incidents, but Prime Minister Harper pledged aggressive action.
In recent weeks, I have been saying that our laws and police powers need to be strengthened in the area of surveillance, detention, and arrest. They need to be much strengthened. And I assure you, Mr. Speaker, that work, which is already underway, will be expedited.
But the city of Ottawa stayed on edge. At one point, as the Prime Minister and his wife laid flowers at the war memorial, police drew their guns and forced a man to the ground. He was later arrested for disturbing the crime scene.
And in other news of this day, six West Africans who traveled to Connecticut are being quarantined for possible exposure to Ebola. Officials said today the family arrived on Saturday, planning to live in the U.S. They'll be monitored for 21 days. There was also word that a New York hospital is testing a man with Ebola-like symptoms who worked for Doctors Without Borders in West Africa. We'll hear from the president's top science officer on stopping Ebola after the news summary.
In Nigeria, suspected Boko Haram militants kidnapped at least 25 girls in a remote northeastern town. It came amid ongoing talks aimed at freeing more than 200 other girls seized by the Islamist group in April. The abduction also raised further doubts about a ceasefire announcement last week.
New questions surfaced today about the U.S. strategy to confront Islamic State forces. The Washington Post reported moderate Syrians will be trained to defend themselves, but not to try to retake territory. The report cited unnamed U.S. and allied officials. Islamic State militants already control large swaths of Syria and neighboring Iraq.
The Maryland man who allegedly jumped the White House fence last night was ordered held without bond today. Dominic Adesanya was quickly arrested by uniformed Secret Service agents and their dogs. He was unarmed, but he's charged with punching and kicking the dogs and making threats. White House spokesman Josh Earnest said today the challenge is to balance security with public access.
I think the point is it certainly would be possible to build a multi-story bomb-proof wall around the 18-acre complex of the White House. But that, I don't think, would be striking the appropriate balance that I described earlier.
Last month, another fence jumper made it past five layers of security and into the White House.
California's prison system will end its policy of locking down inmates based on race. Guards have frequently invoked the policy after racial violence among inmates, regardless of whether they are directly implicated. The settlement would end a long-standing civil rights lawsuit.
A batch of strong earnings reports sent Wall Street surging again today. The Dow Jones Industrial Average gained 216 points to close near 16,678. The Nasdaq rose almost 70 points to close at 4452, and the S&P added 23 to finish at 1950. Still to come on the news hour, innovations aiding the fight against Ebola. What Michael Brown's autopsy tells us about what happened in Ferguson. Fake grades, fake papers, and fake classes at the University of North Carolina. Why it's hard to know what's happening in Syria's civil war. And an all-star cast revives a comedy about the laughs behind the curtains of Broadway.
The World Health Organization reported the Ebola outbreak is still racing well ahead of efforts to stop it. West Africa needs at least 4,000 more hospital beds and thousands more workers. In addition, the first case in Mali was confirmed today. And while drugs and vaccines are still being developed, there's a push to see if science can find new and different answers. The president's team had a meeting on that subject today. Shortly afterward, our science correspondent, Miles O'Brien, sat down in the briefing room with the president's top science advisor, John Holdren.
Dr. Holdren, thank you so much for being with us.
Happy to be here.
Tell us a little bit, for people who are uninitiated, a little bit about this group and this meeting. What was the goal here today?
Well, the President's Council of Advisors on Science and Technology is a group of leaders from the scientific, engineering, and biomedical communities from around the country who advise the President on a part-time basis, bringing perspectives from that wider science and technology community to bear on the policy issues the President has on his plate. Of course, one of the big policy issues the President has on his plate now is the Ebola challenge. And the idea of this meeting was to call together the PCAST members at the President's request to share their ideas with him, particularly about what capabilities, ideas, and approaches from the private sector and the academic sector could be married to what the government is already doing on the Ebola challenge, which is a lot, in order to amplify and improve the effectiveness of the whole effort.
Let's talk a little bit about technology here. Yeah. Are there technological solutions out there that are within the time frame of the current crisis that could make a dent? And one of the things we think about, of course, is protecting our healthcare workers. Is there a better garment and a better procedure out there that your group is seeing?
Well, in fact, we have been working inside the government on better personal protective equipment. They call it PPE. We had a two-day workshop October 10th and 11th with over 100 innovators, inventors, public health practitioners, doctors working on how to improve these garments. Of course, part of the challenge with the garments we have is making sure you put them on and take them off in a way that is safe. But a further problem with them is that they're not air-conditioned. And a lot of this work is going on in very hot and humid environments. The workers can only stay in these garments for maybe 40 minutes to an hour. So we're working on garments that can be cooled. We also have assistance from NASA in this space. This is a very much inside the government and interagency effort. NASA knows how to make protective suits that work in extreme environments. We are tapping that expertise along with others to end up with better suits so that the healthcare workers can work longer and safer.
So if we can put a man on the moon, we can make them safe to deal with Ebola, can't
exactly.
We?
Yeah. Exactly.
Let's talk a little bit about another technological solution that I read about. I was a little bit skeptical about it. The idea that robots could somehow be employed to deal with this crisis in a way that would protect human beings. Is that realistic at this point?
Well, in fact, we are having a workshop, my office, the Office of Science and Technology Policy, and a number of other partners on November 7th on potential uses of robots in the Ebola challenge. Perhaps the best example of how a robot could be useful is cleaning up and decontaminating a room that has had Ebola patients in it and has a lot of contaminated stuff in it. Obviously, if you could have a robot do that and do it effectively, it would be safer than having a human being dealing with all of that contaminated waste and mess.
But are robots really ready for that?
I think they probably are. I mean, you would be amazed at what robots can now do. We have robots being developed that can fight fires and go into dangerous fire situations that you wouldn't want to send a human fireman into.
But
we can certainly make a robot that can decontaminate a room.
I suspect that's not within the time frame of the immediate crisis, however, right?
I wouldn't be so sure. I think we could probably adapt some existing robots to be useful in the current situation in a fairly short span of time.
All right, let's talk a little bit on the science side for a minute. I know this is not your particular area of expertise, so and there are other people in the government.
Thank
who
you
are,
for recognizing that.
You're a physicist, and I get that. So, but there are a lot of people who've been working for some time on vaccines in Israel.
Absolutely.
But you know, Ebola's been around for a long time, and we're still waiting for a vaccine. Is it still quite some time before one might be available?
Well, obviously, the current crisis has ramped up the interest and the effort in developing an Ebola vaccine. There is a promising vaccine in what they call phase one testing right now, looking to confirm the immunological response that one is looking for in a vaccine that would then, if it passes that test, go into what they call phase two and three testing, where they're looking for efficacy and the absence of any unmanageable side effects. It is possible that we would have a vaccine by sometime next year. These time scales are challenging. You have to do clinical trials to be sure that you're dealing with a vaccine that is going to do a lot of good and not a lot of harm on the side. But with luck, we will have a vaccine in a matter of months, not in years. But then you have the challenges of ramping up the production. And one of the things that the PCAST, the President's Council of Advisors on Science and Technology is looking at is how can the government and the private sector work together to make sure that we have the production capacity that would be needed the moment we have a good vaccine.
I'd be remiss if we didn't talk about the travel ban. Much discussed, much misunderstood. The question is, if you're trying to stop the spread of a disease, isn't it prudent to stop the spread of the people who might be carrying the disease? And wouldn't it be prudent to initiate a travel ban from people coming out of these countries?
We think a travel ban is actually a bad idea, and that it would make the American public less safe and our challenge of dealing with this epidemic worse. And the reason is that if you emplace a travel ban, first of all, you only catch a modest fraction of the people who are moving around. We have, for example, about 150 people a day traveling directly to the United States from these countries. That is not on a broken itinerary where they stop for a week in London or Paris or Brussels in between. About 150 a day. 55% of those are American citizens who have a constitutional right to return to the United States. Another 10% are green card holders who one is not sure their permanent residence. We're not sure that it would be a great idea to keep American green card holders from returning. But the worst thing about a travel ban is that it would drive travel underground. Right now, we are able to identify and monitor the people who are coming in from these countries. As you know from the newspaper, we now have them all funneling into five airports. Everybody who comes in from these countries is advised to monitor and report in every day on their temperature and whether they're showing any symptoms. You put a travel ban on, you're going to drive the travel underground. There are lots of routes by which people can get into this country without being noticed in the net you would have under a travel ban. And you'll have far less control, far less insight, far less monitoring than you have now. You would, in addition, of course, with a travel ban, make it much harder for health workers to come in and out, make it much harder for us to control the epidemic there. If we can't control the epidemic there, the sources from which it could spread to the United States will propagate, and again, in that longer-term respect, we'll also be worse off.
To the extent that you're dealing with, in this country, an epidemic of fear more than an epidemic of a disease, would announcing a travel ban, to the extent that it might allay some fears, would it be prudent in that respect?
I think embracing a bad policy for reasons of optics is almost always a bad idea. In fact, as a scientist, I would venture to say it is always a bad idea. If this is a bad policy, we shouldn't do it. And we should use our ability to communicate with the American public and to educate them, to persuade them why it's a bad idea. It's a bad idea because it would make us less safe and not more safe.
Dr. John Holdren, thank you so much for your time.
My pleasure.
So far, the more immediate Ebola threat, domestically at least, has been the fear and anxiety it has sparked. Online, we break down the impact this kind of stress can have on your health. That's on our rundown.
Protests continue in Ferguson, Missouri, 75 days after teenager Michael Brown was shot and killed by police. The latest round last night was sparked after details from the official autopsy report of Brown, conducted by the county, were leaked to the St. Louis Post-Dispatch. Joining us now is Dr. Judy Melnick. She is a forensic pathologist and associate professor of pathology at the University of California, San Francisco Medical Center. She reviewed the autopsy for the Post-Dispatch. Dr. Melnick, thank you very much for joining us. So you were provided with a copy of this autopsy report. What did you take away from it? What did you learn?
What I got from the report was that there's a gunshot wound of the thumb that's going from the tip of the thumb towards the wrist. And that particular wound, they had microscopic sections of. So this is new information. There's particulate material in that wound that's consistent with gunpowder. And we now know that there have been one or two gunshots in the vehicle. So that is most likely the shot that occurred while the struggle was occurring in the vehicle, and it indicates that the hand was in line with the gun, meaning that the thumb was pointing towards the muzzle of the gun for that trajectory to make sense.
So what does that tell us about what happened? Why is that significant information?
It's significant only in that it's different from what we had heard from the second autopsy. Remember, the second autopsy was done after the first autopsy was completed by the St. Louis Medical Examiner, and that's done on a body that's been washed and been embalmed, and all of the evidence has been taken off of it as part of the primary independent autopsy. So a second autopsy is not going to catch trace evidence such as this. And so this is different information because it confirms that a close-range gunshot wound occurred of the hand, probably during the struggle in the vehicle.
So the second autopsy report, that refers to the autopsy that was commissioned by Michael Brown's family, I think a week or two after the incident.
That is correct.
So can one conclude then, Dr. Melnick, from this, how Michael Brown died?
Well, we know he died from multiple gunshot wounds. That's not a question. The issues in the case pertain to what we call trajectory analysis in forensics. So when you have multiple eyewitnesses, and there have been multiple eyewitnesses, and they're all giving different stories or slightly different stories, the question then becomes for the forensic pathologist is, do you look at the wounds on the body, and then how do you line them up? And how do those line up with the stories that you're being given? And that's the information that's going to be presented to the grand jury. Not just the witness testimony, but the forensic evidence. And it's up to the grand jury to decide whether the forensic evidence is matching with the witness's statements or not.
So just to be perfectly clear about this, listening to what you've just said, what questions are answered by this autopsy report? And what questions have yet to be answered?
Well, what's answered is we know that he died from multiple gunshot wounds. It confirms the number of gunshot wounds, so a minimum of 6, a maximum of 8. And it also shows us that there's a downward trajectory at the top of the head, which really makes sense under these circumstances if Mr. Brown is leaning forward or moving forward with his head down. So that way the top of his head is exposed to the bullet and to the officer who's shooting at him. So that can be interpreted in lots of different ways. It depends on what the witnesses say. It could be that some people would perceive that as he's collapsing or that he's surrendering and bending down, or others could say that he's lunging or moving toward the officer. You can have multiple interpretations that match up with the trajectories. There are also going to be multiple witness statements that don't match up with the trajectories, and it's really up to the grand jury to get all that information and synthesize it and make a decision.
So the questions that cannot be answered by this are several. It's as you said, how far away, it's not so much how far away the gun was, but what else was going on at that time.
It's also questions pertaining to what else is at the scene. We don't have the scene data. We don't have the police reports. We don't have all the witness statements. There's other information that hasn't been gleaned. For instance, where were the casings? How distant was the officer actually from Mr. Brown when the shot started and when they ended? And then also, how high is the weapon off the ground? How tall is the officer and the height of the muzzle when he is pointing it? So all of these are data points. All of this is information that we still don't have and that should be presented in order to get a more nuanced picture, a more complete picture of what happened here.
You've obviously dealt with a number of many cases over the course of your career. Is it possible to say from this what the grand jury would take away from this?
At this point, we can't say what the grand jury is going to do, and it's going to depend on what they see, and they're sequestered, and they're going to be seeing evidence that we don't see. All we've been given is what was apparently leaked. So it's not a complete picture by any means, and their determination is going to be based on the complete set of data, not on just snippets of what we're seeing here.
Last question, Dr. Melnick. Michael Brown's family has said that they do not accept the results of this autopsy report by the St. Louis County Medical Examiner, or they said any account that comes from an official account that supports what the police officer, Darren Wilson, has said. My question to you is, how credible, how much can one count on the accuracy of this autopsy report or any autopsy report?
I want to reiterate that medical examiners, forensic pathologists, are not police. We're not cops. We are independent practitioners. We're physicians. In St. Louis, the Medical Examiner is an independent agency and is part of the Department of Health, not the police. They're not in the business of covering up for the police. They're in the business of collecting evidence and documenting it. And you have to understand that all that evidence eventually becomes public record. So whether a family trusts it or distrusts it, and it's perfectly understandable that people will distrust public agencies when there has been a death in police custody or an officer-involved shooting. That's understandable. But these are physicians at the Medical Examiner's Office, and they're collecting the evidence, and that evidence will be presented to the grand jury. And whether they indict or not, it will eventually all become public. So there will be complete scrutiny. There will be access to all that information, and it will eventually come to light. We just have to let the justice system do its thing, take its time, and be cautious and understanding as that happens.
Dr. Judy Melnick at the University of California at San Francisco, we thank you.
Thank you.
For many years, the University of North Carolina has been a powerhouse in the world of college sports, enhanced by a reputation as an institution which cultivates student athletes. But yesterday, an independent investigator provided the most detailed look yet at academic fraud that lasted for nearly two decades and included bogus classes where students didn't even need to show up. Earlier this year, the HBO program Real Sports examined what was happening there. Here's an excerpt. The correspondent is Bernard Goldberg.
At the University of North Carolina, learning specialist Mary Willingham was baffled by what she was seeing from the athletes arriving at one of America's most prestigious schools.
They're coming in with reading levels of fourth, fifth, sixth grade. There's even some who are reading below a fourth grade level.
You're saying that some kids were admitted to the University of North Carolina, one of the best public colleges in America, with a fourth grade or even in some cases lower than a fourth grade reading level?
That's correct. Makes it pretty hard to go to college, doesn't it?
You would think. And for many years, the NCAA had a rule to help ensure incoming athletes could handle college work, requiring them to score a certain level on standardized tests like the SAT or the ACT. But in 2003, that rule was revoked. Colleges could now put athletes on the football field or basketball court no matter how they did on the tests. And soon, the term college education began to take on a whole new meaning.
I worked with letters and sounds with some basketball players and some football players.
Give me a demonstration, letters and sounds.
So I start to just show you cards, you know, like a deck of cards, and I hold up C, and I say to you, Bernie, what is this letter? And you say,
C.
And I say, what sounds does the letter C make? And you say,
either ka or sa.
And let's move on.
But the kids in college.
One particular player said to me, please teach me to read well enough, Mary, so that I can read about myself online. How about this letter?
Teaching phonics to college students may sound absurd, but at UNC and many other big-time sports schools, it was suddenly very important business. Because the NCAA's new policy that eliminated minimum SAT and ACT scores for athletes came with a catch. Roughly half the athletes on each team would have to graduate, or the schools wouldn't be allowed to compete in the postseason and would lose out on millions. That's one of the reasons, Mary Willingham says, big-time athletes at UNC were funneled into custom-made, no-show classes they couldn't possibly fail.
They would just have to turn in a paper at the end of the semester. There was no class.
When you say no class, you mean no class?
No class.
They didn't ever go to class?
They never went to class.
So they never took a test?
They never took a test.
They wrote a paper?
Not really wrote a paper, but maybe copy and pasted a paper from a book or from an internet site.
This is a bad joke, what you're describing.
It was a horrible joke. No learning took place.
I was like, hold up, you know, I got a class, I'm getting credited 3 hours, and I never have to go.
That's not all that surprised Mike McAdoo when he arrived at UNC to play football.
When I got there, they already had what we were going to major in.
But you're not suggesting, Michael, that somebody handed you a piece of paper and said, here are your classes.
That's what happened.
Former federal prosecutor Kenneth Weinstein led the investigation that unearthed the new details. He's a partner at the firm of Cadwalader, Wickersham and Taft. I spoke with him from Chapel Hill earlier today. Kenneth Weinstein, thanks for joining us. Could you first of all start by describing the scope of the fraud in years, numbers of students, and types of students involved?
Well, what we found in our investigation is this is a scheme that went back to 1993. From 1993 to 2011, there are about 3,100 students who took these paper classes. And the paper classes were classes which, though many of them were designated as lecture classes, they never actually met for lectures. The students never met with a professor. There are no professors or faculty members involved. And the class was completely managed by the office administrator, and the office administrator did the grading. Of the kids who took those classes, a little over 50%, about 51% of them were non-athlete students, so regular students. But a good 48, 49% of them were student athletes, which is striking given that only 4% of the student body were student athletes.
Well, let's start by explaining just the student-athlete piece of this. Was this designed to help them remain eligible to keep playing on Tar Heel teams?
Yeah, it's an interesting question, and this is one thing we looked very carefully at. Why did these classes get established, and why were they maintained? We found that really they were established by the office administrator in the African Studies Department. She did it because she, frankly, she'd had a tough experience as a student here in Chapel Hill, felt that she wasn't supported, and felt that she wanted to do something to help kids who had troubles, who were having difficulty getting through their curriculum. So she is the one who set up these classes, made them available to students and student-athletes and non-student-athletes. And then you had a number of counselors who were the counselors for the student-athletes who saw these classes and saw them as an opportunity to boost the GPAs of their players and maintain their eligibility to play NCAA sports.
Describe what you mean by paper classes, bogus classes. We keep hearing the term shadow curriculum. How did that work specifically?
Yeah, another important part of our investigation was to find out what these classes really were. And what we determined is that these were classes where the office administrator in the African Studies Department would sign kids up for a class, sometimes designated as a lecture class, but the class would never meet. The student wouldn't have any work that he or she would have to do other than a single paper that would have to be turned in at the end of the year. That paper would get turned in, but it wouldn't get graded by a faculty member. It would get graded by the office administrator, really the secretary of the African Studies Department, and she would basically give an A or a B plus to any paper that got turned in, no matter how good it was. And we saw some which were very strong papers. Kids did a lot of work. Others which were terribly subpar and really were just filled with copied material, which meant that a kid got a high grade for a three-hour class for doing nothing more than just turning in a paper that had a bunch of copy material in it.
Mr. Weinstein, we've been hearing about this scandal at UNC for some years now, but it's kind of shocking how long it went on. How was it allowed to go on for so long?
Well, that's another part of our investigation, I think, that's really caught people's attention, which is here you have a university which really is one of the finest universities, always has been and is now one of the finest universities in the country, and is one that's completely committed to the highest ideals and standards of academia. And this question is, how in the world could this go on for so long, about 19 years in a school like that? And what we found is that there just simply wasn't the oversight that was needed. You had a university that I think was populated by people who were high caliber academicians and administrators who trusted each other to be, you know, to do the right thing by the students, and the vast majority of people did. And they didn't think that they really needed to look. There's a bit of a blind spot there. And in addition, I think you saw this attitude that, you know, if we have too much micromanagement, maybe that's going to undercut the independence and the creativity of the professors and of the academics. And so because of both those reasons, they just didn't have a tradition of having strict oversight. And as a result, you had the department and this office administrator and her department chairman who were able to carry this on for all these years, and it just wasn't detected at the higher levels of the administration. And I can tell you that that has been changed over the last few years. The university has put those oversight mechanisms in place so this can't happen again.
You mentioned a bit of a blind spot. Along the way, did any of the sports coaches or any of the professors object? Did they raise the red flag?
Well, you had limited knowledge around the university of exactly what these classes were. You had a lot of people who knew that these were easy classes, that you didn't actually have to show up to class. They were being taught as an independent study. But you had only a limited number of people who really knew that these classes, you know, didn't involve a professor at all. So you had no faculty member, and that they're actually, you know, being run and the papers are being graded by an office administrator. But of those people who did know about that, a number of them were counselors over in the athletics, in the program that provides academic advising to athletes. And they did not raise their hand. They did not say that these problems existed. And in fact, they took advantage of them.
And finally, UNC is not alone in this. A lot of universities have been implicated in these kinds of questionable activities. And it makes you wonder if the term student athlete is a little bit backward at this point.
Well, there have been other schools that have had some problems, and those have been reported, and the NCAA has dealt with some of them over the years. And I think if there's one positive outcome to this whole episode, and I think there will be several, but one of them is, I think any university around the country that reads this is probably going to step back and think, boy, we better go look and see whether there's something like this here. That look back didn't happen with UNC, and they regret that greatly, because had they looked back, you know, looked in their own, on their own campus to see whether this kind of problem existed, they'd have found it and hopefully would have prevented a bunch of kids getting deficient education for a number of years.
Kenneth Weinstein, thank you for your investigation and your report.
Thank you very much. Good to talk to you.
University administrators say they've already started taking several steps to make sure similar abuses don't happen again. That includes spot checks to make sure classes are indeed taking place, real reviews of an athlete's eligibility, and the creation of confidential channels so employees can report potential problems. 9 employees have been fired or disciplined so far.
Now to covering a horrific conflict in the world's most dangerous country for journalists and the limitations that is placing on what the world finds out about. Hari Srinivasan reports.
But Akhidi says he needs more from Turkey and the West.
The NewsHour's Margaret Warner reporting outside Aleppo, Syria in November 2012, when journalists routinely operated in a war zone with few clear battle lines.
We traveled to the rebel-liberated zone in northwest Syria to see what 20 months of conflict had wrought.
Just days after that report was filed, journalist James Foley, whose work had appeared on the NewsHour over the years, was kidnapped in a location nearby. 40-year-old Foley and fellow captive reporter Stephen Sotloff were beheaded by Islamic State militants within weeks of each other recently. They are only 2 of the 70-plus journalists killed covering the Syrian war, which has claimed the lives of nearly 200,000 Syrians since 2011. The very act of telling the stories of uprooted Syrians as the conflict rages across Syria and Iraq has become prohibitively difficult and dangerous. The NewsHour and many other news organizations have decided not to send in staff or freelancers inside of Syria until the security situation improves. Today, the few international journalists who are going rarely travel outside areas controlled by the Syrian regime.
It's very difficult.
CBS News' Clarissa Ward is a recent exception to that rule. She interviewed Western jihadis fighting in northern Syria earlier this month.
And winter is coming. These people.
After months of negotiations, we met a 26-year-old Dutch fighter called Yilmaz.
And over the summer, a cameraman from Vice News embedded with Islamic State fighters. Vice has not said what, if any, restrictions were placed on its coverage.
Islamic State press officer Abu Mossa said he would take Vice News to see the front lines.
But in large measure, much of the reporting on Syria is done from outside, as reporters rely on sources inside the country, on social media, and extensive but hard-to-vet video posted online by rebels and Islamic State sources. So, as furious fighting and American airstrikes continue at the Syrian town of Kobani, the closest most viewers and readers will get is just across the border in Turkey.
Joining me now to discuss the dangers of covering Syria and how it impacts our understanding of the conflict is veteran international correspondent Deborah Amos. She's been reporting on the Syrian civil war since its beginning in 2011 for NPR. And John Danishevsky, the senior managing editor for international news at the Associated Press. The PBS NewsHour is a subscriber to the AP. Deborah, I want to start with you. You've covered this conflict and you've covered the region for quite some time. How difficult is it to cover Syria versus anywhere else in the region?
Oh, it's very, very tough, and it's gotten tougher over time. You're up against two problems. One is the so-called Islamic State. They'll kill you if you cross the border and they catch you. And then you have the Assad government that restricts visas. Right now, there are no visas for U.S.-based correspondents, people who hold U.S. passports, and they have an army that make sure that you cannot come into the country. So the problem is you have two main groups who do not want you to be there and have it in their power to keep you out. It is dangerous not only inside Syria now, but also on the border. My last reporting trip, for the first time ever in my career, I was not allowed to say where I was because I was there for 3.5 weeks, and it was considered by my company that it was dangerous to say, and that has now become a policy. It's very unusual to do that.
John, you're in the position of deciding when to send reporters and when not to. What's so specifically challenging, besides what Deborah just said, about covering this conflict, given that the AP covers conflicts all over the globe?
Yes, well, I think every conflict involves making difficult choices. We try to very carefully weigh the risks against the advantages of going to any certain place. And right now, we consider Syria to be at the top of the most extremely dangerous places in the world to report from. And that has been a problem.
So, Deborah, I want to ask, what stories are we missing from there when we have such limited access for Western reporters or any reporters to get in and find the stories?
I think we're actually missing a lot. I mean, it's obvious that we aren't being able to report the bad news. But we also can't report developments there. I'll give you an example. In my hotel, the last time I was in southern Turkey, there was a contingent of police officers from Aleppo, a town that's been under siege for more than a year, split between the regime and the rebels. These police officers came from the rebel side of the city, and their programs are being funded by the United States, by Norway, by the Dutch government. There were 36 Aleppo police, including women, in my hotel for their training programs. Now, I would love to be able to go to Aleppo and follow them on the beat for a day. I can't do that. So I really can't report on if this U.S.-funded program is going well or not inside Aleppo. I think that we are missing nuance that's always important and that we've always been able to report on any conflict zone, and it's just not getting reported inside Syria.
John Danishevsky, are you hearing similar stories from your reporters, hearing stories that you can't report on?
Yes, we get reports from things that are going on inside Syria, and they're very difficult to verify. We're relying in this conflict, I think, to a greater extent than ever on user-generated content, social media, the photos that people there send out. But we have very high standards, which of those we will use and how we verify them. So, you know, even in the middle of the night last night, we were chasing one particular report in the city of Kobani, and we were never able to satisfy it, to satisfy ourselves that it was verified that we could report it. But we do have means. We do have contacts inside that we can reach out to. We do have very experienced journalists in the area who are picking up reports and sifting through them. It's a sort of a pillar of conflict coverage to talk about what's happening to those caught in the middle. And that's really a bit of what we're missing right now.
So, Deb Amos, with all that said, how do you do it? Your assignment is still to get stories from Syria. Who do you talk to? What videos are you watching to be able to corroborate these facts on the ground?
You know, I often think we are like foreign correspondents of 100 years ago, where people would stand at the docks and they would interview people as they got off big ships. So what we do is we're at the borders of Turkey, where we can talk to people when they come across. You can go to hospitals on the border. You can interview people who've been wounded in some of the fights inside. And you can piece together, if you do enough of this, what it's like in a particular battlefield. You can interview people who are coming out of Raqqa, where the so-called Islamic State is ruling. And you can ask them details about what's life like, and you can eventually build a picture. But that is really what we have to do. You have to go down, and it's piece by piece by piece to build a picture of what's going on inside Syria. It's not impossible. And you can see from both the AP point of view and mine that that is what we're doing. It's painstaking work. We are watching the videos. You have to verify all those videos. It is doable. But I just wonder what we're missing.
All right, John Danishevsky. So what about the market incentives or disincentives when it comes to freelancers? A lot of times they'll end up risking their lives and going places because they might be more nimble than a large institution. But what does the Associated Press do to try and keep people out of harm's way by trying to go in and get that one shot?
Well, first of all, we won't send a freelancer to cover something that we wouldn't ourselves go to do. And we have rules about not taking material from people whom we don't know, who are not insured, who do not have proper protection. And so we have sent reporters into Syria in the past. We're not doing it right now because of the dangers discussed earlier. And we're not sending freelancers in right now either. And I think across all news organizations in the industry, there's a very robust discussion going on right now. What can we do, both in the mainline or the established news organizations, and how can the freelancers organize themselves to better protect themselves and be better prepared to face a hostile environment?
All right, John Danishevsky from the Associated Press and Deborah Amos from NPR. Thanks so much for your time.
Thank you. Finally tonight, it's only a play, but one with an all-star cast and a lot of laughs. It's also one of the hottest tickets on Broadway. Jeffrey Brown went to see why.
All my life I've dreamed they'd yell, author, author, when I walked into my opening night party. They did, but it was for Tom Stoppard, who was right behind me.
The actual play is called It's Only a Play, a rollicking show within a show about the craziness, pain, and ultimate thrill of theater life. Matthew Broderick is the writer of a fictional play titled, and you know this can't be good, The Golden Egg, awaiting the first reviews at a celebrity-studded party after opening night.
All Broadway and half of Hollywood are down there. Steven Spielberg asked me if I wanted to write a screenplay for him. Sure, I said. What about? Good point, he said, and he walked away.
In It's Only a Play, Broderick has been reunited with Nathan Lane, who plays his old friend, an actor now working in television, who is, let's say, less than supportive.
Of course I would have been wonderful in the part. It was written for me. Thank God for my series. Or I might have had to tell Peter the truth about his god-awful play. But do you think I got so much as even a mention in the program? I only created the lead in his one and only hit, and no mention. The egos in this business.
The actual writer is Terrence McNally, and for this revival of his 1980s play, he's updated references to celebrities and technology while keeping the behind-the-scenes backstabbing and name-dropping.
I said to one woman, you look just like Hillary Clinton. She said, I hope so. I am Hillary Clinton.
It's all helped along by what is itself a celebrity cast that includes F. Murray Abraham as a vicious drama critic, Megan Mullally as a loony first-time producer, and Stockard Channing as an aging actress who knows her way around pharmaceuticals. This afternoon in New York, I sat down with Matthew Broderick and Terrence McNally.
Welcome to both of you.
Thank you.
Matthew Broderick, so waiting for the review, especially from the New York Times, is it as close to a near-death experience as it looks in the play?
Yeah, I think it sort of is. I don't usually like to admit it, but this play admits how how frightened we all are, I guess.
Really?
Yeah. I mean, maybe not everybody.
And
is.
We're the only art form that does that. Novelists don't wait, you know, in 1 hour they're going to be told if they're book is good or not.
Well, you've put him as your sort of alter ego on
stage,
your surrogate. But you watch feeling his pain, your pain?
Yes, it's very public what we do, and show the reviews. But, you know, a novelist isn't there when you throw the book on the floor and say, this is terrible. The playwright and the actors are there We know that night.
Yeah. And then we go back the next night and do the play again.
and pretend it was well-received, even if it wasn't. Fortunately, this play was well-received, so we don't have to do that part of the make-believe.
But even that, you can recover. I mean, even if you have a bad night with your reviews, a week or two later, the play comes back to you.
You know, I saw it yesterday. I was wondering, is it a love letter to Broadway or almost a hate letter? I mean, there's so much skewering going on of what Broadway is today.
I think it's finally a very big love letter.
Yeah.
But yeah, I think we do some things that are absurd and we can look at critically. But I do love the theater, and I think these people love the theater. And I think New York audiences love the theater. Broadway ain't going away. In fact, right now it's doing better than ever, so...
But the references to, and you some of them come out of your mouth, right? The references to the Brits taking over, Disney films made into movies, movie stars, you know, trying to rev up their careers by coming back to Broadway. Irish dancers. I could go on and on as you did.
It's
not a pretty picture.
Well, he tries to evenly attack everyone, I think.
Including the people on the stage, right?
Yes.
In front of myself, I think.
Yeah, absolutely.
We let our self-worth be defined by other people. Mm-hmm. You can say that's a very bad way to live your life.
is that what it is as an actor?
It can be. It's something to avoid. Yeah. I mean, it's a danger that you start to just live through what do people think of me, and you have to try to somehow not do that.
Right.
But you've been doing this since you were quite young. I mean, have you always felt that, or have you found ways to get past it?
My memory is that it didn't used to bother me, but I bet it did. I don't really actually read reviews, if that's what we're talking about. I try not to, but there's no avoiding every audience. I'm asking them to like me in some way, so that is part of the game. But I don't know how to deal with it.
Why don't you read reviews?
Well, for one thing, I don't want my feelings hurt, but also, I think that is the reason. But even when they're good, they can make you self-conscious about something that you might not want to be. Maybe you could learn from them, but I've given it up.
I finally stopped reading them about three or four plays ago. Mm-hmm. But what's bad about reviews is the good ones are never good enough, and the bad ones are like just emblazoned, like branding iron. I can quote the reviewer in the play about Wish... The parents of the playwright had smothered him in his cradle was written about me, my first play.
Really?
You don't forget that.
You do.
3 years later, I'm still quoting it.
And you're putting it into
a
play.
And
so
I've gotten
a
few
good
reviews in the meantime, but I don't care about that.
Well, you know, you both had successes and you both had some bombs, right? Have you figured out what makes a show work?
No. No, I don't think
no one. No one has. For a while, it seemed maybe Neil Simon had. He had like 6 hits in a flow in a row. But Shakespeare didn't figure it out.
Uh-huh.
He's got a very up and down career if you look what are considered the great plays and the ones that aren't maybe so great. It's how it should be.
Well, so what makes you keep going? I mean, I watch that this play and you see the pain and the kind of horror in a way. But what makes you keep coming back?
Well, there's a lot of joy in it, too. I mean, there are the horrible moments, but there are also the times when things are going well. And, you know, half the time more than half, we love doing it. We just started the play, and I can see that in the eyes. My castmates, we are extremely happy a lot of the time, and when the audience is with us and his beautiful words, it's a very fine time.
And I can stand at the back and say I wrote that, and they're performing it well, and there's 1,000 people laughing or being moved by this moment. The play gets touching at times, and I can take pride in that.
And then there are those nights where maybe they're not doing it exactly the way.
Yeah, then you want to shoot everybody.
Starting
with yourself. But we do it because I think we want to entertain. We want to be heard. We think we have something to say to people.
Terrence McNally and Matthew Broderick, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Again, the major developments of the day. Canadian police said they have found no link between yesterday's attack in Ottawa that left one soldier dead and the killing of another soldier this week. And the World Health Organization warned that Ebola in West Africa is still racing well ahead of efforts to stop it.
On the NewsHour online right now, should the U.S. extend more visas to foreign science and technology workers? A new study suggests it could help boost American wages. That's on our Making Sense page. All that and more is on our website, pbs.org/newshour.
And that's the NewsHour for tonight. On Friday, we talked to legendary singer Tony Bennett about performing with pop star Lady Gaga. I'm Judy Woodruff.
And I'm Gwen Ifill. We'll see you online and again here tomorrow evening with Mark Shields and David Brooks. For all of us here at the PBS NewsHour, thank you and good night.
Major funding for the PBS NewsHour has been provided by...
Economy for 160 years. BNSF, the engine that connects us.
And by BAE Systems, inspired work. The Lemelson Foundation, committed to improving lives through invention in the U.S. and developing countries. On the web at lemelson.org. And with the ongoing support of these institutions.
This program was made possible by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and by contributions to your PBS station from viewers like you. Thank you.